Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Say my name.
Mike Florio.
Get the name right. That's all that matters. Spell my name right or say my name properly.
Pro Football Talk and NBC Sports.
Hearing Florio writing any articles about it.
NFL Insider.
Take a spin around the league. We bring in Pro Football Talk's Mike Florio.
Mike Florio.
My name is my name.
With Bernstein and McKnight on 670 The Score.
The top of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. With four remaining home games left, the Chicago Wolves have a magic number to capture their third straight division that sits at only six. Be there Saturday and Sunday as they look to clinch. Tickets start at only $12. Visit ChicagoWolves.com for information.
Some crazy stuff going on with the AAF folding up, and it got a ton of investment from Tom Dundon, $250 million in total. And that was promised to be money for them to use for a good long time.
It sounded like it was promised to be money.
And it sounded like it was too good to be true. We'll talk Mike Florio in just a few here, but this is kind of the story that's rounding through pro football. And it's the way what's confusing about this and kind of crazy about the business model of the AAF is the way it tried to tie itself to the NFL and failed to do so.
Mike Florio joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. You follow him on Twitter at Pro Football Talk, NBC Sports Pro Football Talk. And Mike, this is there's some skullduggery afoot here, it would appear, in this story. What do you know about how the apparent demise of the AAF went down?
Well, look, it all comes down to money and the willingness of Tom Dundon, who came in and saved the league 6 weeks ago, to continue to pay the bills without any strong belief that he ultimately was going to see a return on his investment. And I think he was in it long enough to realize that you can't get there from here. Now, this idea that there needed to be a deal with the NFL and the NFL Players Association for bottom of the roster futures type practice squad players to help the AAF survive. A lot of people looked at that and said, if it's not going to survive without these guys that no one has ever heard of, it's not going to survive with those guys either. You're not going to get there with the ability to put the Bears logo at the, you know, bottom of the collar on a guy's jersey, so Bears fans will be tuned in to see what their third string center can do in the AAF. That's not going to give it the lift necessary to get to where it needed to be. And for whatever reason, Tom Dundon hung his hat on that idea, and that was in his mind the thing that caused him to pull the plug. A lot of people think that was just a pretext for him choosing to decide after 6 weeks, you know what, not a good investment. And instead of spending another $20 million to get through the rest of the season, he'll kiss goodbye the $70 million that he already put in, and he'll have a write-off, he'll have a tax shelter, however that all works out for billionaires who end up paying less taxes than they should. That's how it goes, and see you later, AAF. And that's basically it. It's not about the football. It's not about the ratings. It's not about the revenue. My understanding is they were exactly where they thought they were supposed to be. The problem is they don't have the money. And here's the thing. The fact that no one else stepped up and wrote a big check, it tells me that people who have money, for the most part, don't want to invest in something so speculative when there is no clear indication that you're going to make money on the back end.
The other aspect of this, and you can speak to this also as a lawyer, perhaps, because Albert Breer reported that Dundon may have done this, buying a majority stake and allowing himself to own the intellectual property, that it was never really about football, but it was about owning a gambling app, all of the tech and data for a specific gambling app that was owned by the AAF. And once he vested enough, or once he was rock solid in being able to own that, he just got out of it because it was never about football in the first place.
Good theory. My understanding is he doesn't own that technology. I mean, other than the fact that the fundamental premise doesn't apply, from what I was told, that you know, makes sense, but he can't walk away with that technology. And I've seen that speculation that he wants to take that technology where you put the chip in the pads of the players, and you see them migrating on real time. It looked like a very old school video game, the app that they have, but that provides the foundation for real time in-game betting with no latency whatsoever. It was like milliseconds of a delay from the various AAF stadiums to your cell phone device, but that's not technology he's going to walk away with. They have other partners who own the rights to that. And so you take that explanation off the table, it's even more dumbfounding that the guy would dump $70 million in and then just walk away.
Yeah, so where did the AAF make their biggest mistake here? Was it in trying to tie themselves as closely to the NFL as they ended up not being able to do? Or was it just taking $250 million on spec from a guy whose motivations were unclear at best?
The inability to find someone who was truly committed to spending whatever it takes to get through the inevitable 3 or 4 years of no money. And what the XFL has is a guy in Vince McMahon who is willing to spend. He just sold $272 million more of WWE stock that is going to be used primarily for the XFL. You have to be willing to say, I will spend whatever it takes to get through those first few years where you have to establish the business. And then you hope that you make the right moves, you make the right decisions, and you ultimately develop something that can generate money, that can generate profit, that can sustain and ultimately pay back everything you put into it and then some.
So does the XFL then immediately work to shore up these current markets where so much of the infrastructure was put in place, so much of the work was done? Can they just sort of grab these and have like squatter's rights to it until they need it?
You know, that's a great thought. And the XFL avoided the 8 cities where the AAF had teams, but some of the cities it worked, and some of the cities it didn't work. San Antonio, it worked. They were getting 30,000 people to show up for these games. And if I'm the XFL, I don't want to get too locked into this idea that, you know what, I have to be in the cities where I've already announced where we're going to have teams. Now, they've got Houston and Dallas, but maybe the Houston team ends up being in San Antonio where you don't. See, here's the challenge. And I think 6 of the 8 XFL cities are cities that have NFL teams. I don't know that that's the right play. I think you want to strategically select these cities. And, you know, here's the other thing, too. And I asked Charlie Ebersol, the co-founder of the AAF, this question last year when they first announced their plans. Why are you spreading these teams all over the country? Aren't the travel costs going to be, you know, and he was dismissive. Basically, we're going to have the funding. That's not going to be an issue. Well, it is an issue. Not that that would have saved the league, but if I was starting one of these leagues, and I'm going to write something up later today at PFT with all the things I would do if I was starting one of these leagues. Not that anybody's going to listen to me, but if it helps somebody, fine. I would, if I'm going to have 8 teams, I'm putting the 8 teams in the Southeast. Maybe sliding over a little bit toward Texas. I want it to be driving distance. I want there to be natural geographic rivalries, and I want to have an incubator where this thing can grow and it can develop a following. And if it works there, you almost like put the country into 4 quadrants. If it works there, I'm going to have 8 more cities or 4 more cities in the Northeast. And then if it works there, I'll go to the Southwest or the Northwest. But you want to start, I think, with manageable financial goals. And it has to be a significant cost difference if you're playing in San Diego and Orlando and Atlanta and Salt Lake City and Phoenix. You're spread across the entire country. And I would jam it all tightly together. And I would try to minimize whatever the bleeding is going to be those first 3 years. I would try to minimize what that bleeding is to make it enticing to somebody who's going to plunk down the money for it.
That sounds eminently reasonable, and I'm sure it'll never happen, Mike.
Exactly. The more reasonable something sounds, the more likely it never actually plays out.
It's Mike Florio. We're talking football with him. Pro Football Talk. You can follow him on Twitter right there, Pro Football Talk. It's the Bernstein and McKnight Show. Mike, I'll admit, I have a complicated and bittersweet relationship with Russell Wilson because of 2011 at Wisconsin, so I'm looking for some clarity here. He's got a complicated relationship with some of his former teammates and the legacy of the Legion of Boom and the Seahawks. He now wants a new contract. He wants it done by April 15th. He's not going to hold out or skip voluntary workouts. Can he get what he wants by seeming to be the good guy?
Well, maybe. And it depends upon how much he wants and at what point the Seahawks choose giving him what he wants versus the Kirk Cousins path, which would consist of Russell Wilson, and bear with me now, he's due to make $17 million this year on the final year of his current deal. But because of his cap number at $25.286 million, his franchise tag amount for next year is $30.34. Then for 2021, it goes up 20% to $36.4 million. And then it gets very interesting. 2022, only 3 years from now, the cap number and the cash value of the franchise tender in year three, by rule, a 44% raise over the prior year, $52.4 million. So at some point on this year-to-year analysis, the Seahawks say, holy crap, $52 million in cap and cash dollars this year for Russell Wilson. Can we do it? Will we do it? And then after that, 2023... you can make the argument you can't franchise tag him again. That is uncharted waters for the NFL and the NFLPA. And the NFLPA believes under the terms of the CBA, you have three franchise tenders and that's it. After that, you can't use it anymore. And so, you know, he can force his way to the open market. The question is he comfortable carrying the injury risk over the next 3 years? And from the Seahawks perspective, how much more are we willing to pay? What are we willing to pay now to avoid that potential dilemma? And from Russell Wilson's standpoint, how much do I take now to give up my power to really, I mean, think about it. Kirk, all due respect, Kirk Cousins isn't very good. Russell Wilson is one of the top five, maybe top three quarterbacks in the NFL. One of these true franchise quarterbacks had to look at what Cousins did last year and say, if this guy can do it, what can I do if I decide to go year to year?
Yeah, we need a separate quarterback cap. I mean, every time we have these conversations, we need to unpeg the quarterback salaries from the remainder of the cap because it just becomes onerous to run a football team.
Keep this in mind, this concept. It's been floated before and no team has ever bit. But Russell Wilson, I believe, is going to try very hard to get a guarantee that his compensation will be tied to a percentage, a fixed percentage of the salary cap, as it continues to go up and up and up. And whether it's 15, 17, 18, whatever it is, think about what's going to happen in the coming years. New TV deals, cap goes up. New CBA, cap may go up. Legalized gambling and all the revenue streams that come from that, cap goes up. So instead of getting 34, 35, 37 million a year, I think you get a floor of hard dollars and you have a ceiling of a percentage of the salary cap. And Kirk Cousins tried to do that. Washington said no. The Jets were asked to do that with Darrelle Revis 9 years ago. The Jets said no. Russell Wilson could be the guy to do it. And the closer he gets to that $52.4 million in 2022, the more likely he is to get it.
It would take an exceptional player to make that happen for team and agent. You don't think that that would then be a trickle-down effect to other, I mean, hell, other positions other than quarterback, do you?
I think anytime somebody stretches the rubber band as far as it can be stretched, you have others who fall in line in the looser phases of that rubber band. And look, Tom Brady, it's his prerogative to not get every last penny that he could, but that's held back other quarterbacks. Well, you know, when you are a quarterback negotiating with a team and you want to make this huge windfall, The Tom Brady elephant in the room doesn't even have to be mentioned. And I think the fact that Brady has declined to do that has made it harder for other quarterbacks. Aaron Rodgers declined to do it. Aaron Rodgers eventually just shrugged his shoulders and did a very conventional deal with the Green Bay Packers. Yes, it made him the highest paid player in football, but the Packers just refused to engage in any of these other tactics, apply any of these other devices. And at some point, you have to wonder whether there's collusion going on, that the individual teams are afraid to do something that is outside the norm because they don't want to get called on the carpet by the management council. And if that's happening, if there are devices that are perfectly legitimate under the CBA and teams refuse to do it because they don't want to get called out by the league and by the management council, that really is collusion. That's where separate businesses are coming together to follow a set of unwritten rules to the detriment of the workforce. Good luck proving it, but if that's what's happening, that's what it is.
Why was the trade market so soft for Jordan Howard?
because of the position that he plays, plain and simple, and $2 million for a guy in his fourth year when you could just draft a guy in round six, round seven, or an undrafted guy like a Philip Lindsay, and you pay him peanuts, and you go just beat the crap out of him, and if he's good, then you keep him around, and if he's not, you go on to the next guy. And you know, obviously, if what they got was a sixth-round pick next year that can go up to a fifth-round pick, that's the best offer that was available. And it just, you know, for 3,300-plus rushing yards in three seasons. But running back is the ultimate chew-them-up, spit-them-out position in the NFL, and Jordan Howard's the latest example of that.
Speaking of, Duke Johnson could be the next example. What are your indications of his potentially being moved?
I mean, there's a few teams that are interested, but Jordan Howard has kind of set the market from a trade value standpoint. What are you going to get for Duke Johnson? And the Browns ultimately have to ask themselves, do we keep him around as insurance in the event that we have an injury to Nick Chubb or something happens with Kareem Hunt when he's finally back on the football field, or do we just take what we can get and move on? And you know, that's why when you see these running back, well, the rare running back that gets a big contract, that is the exception nowadays. And I think from a football team management standpoint, it makes so much more sense to devote those cap dollars to positions where the demand outweighs the supply. Is that right? Yeah, the demand outweighs the supply. With running backs, the supply far outweighs the demand.
Mike, thanks as always, man.
All right, see you guys.
Mike Florio, guess what it's time for next?
The Midday Midway.
Yes, it is.
I have tales of a marathon that anyone could get into. We're also going to talk about a documentary that you may or may not want to see.
I have an island of eponymous fame that is closing because of heists that you won't believe.
Ooh.
I also have when one place's delicacy is another place's scourge. And I have the adventures of very, very stupid rednecks with guns.
The Midday Midway's on the way. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Baseball and football to start this edition of the Bernstein and McKnight show. After Tommy Hotovy, the Cubs' new pitching coach, joined Mully and Haw, we replayed some of his comments and broke down some of his thoughts about Yu Darvish and what it takes to keep him whole and keep him focused. And he is a high effort, high intensity operation to make sure that particular investment is maximized.
Has Mully done the Sound of Music Yu Darvish thing yet? You know, because he breaks into song often and typically for music. I just figured he'd be with the how do you solve a problem like Yu Darvish. I feel like he'd have done that already. If he hasn't, I'll take it.
We also listened to what Joe Maddon had to say with Lawrence Holmes yesterday about the ugly start to the Cubs season. And then Mike Florio on all sorts of things going on in football.
You might be in on a documentary like this. Rick might be, too. I am interested in watching Malice at the Palace in full. There's a documentary coming out about Ron Artest. Brian Mahoney wrote this up in the Associated Press. And footage from the Malice at the Palace will be released in its entirety for the first time in the documentary Quiet Storm, the Ron Artest story. It's going to come out May 31st. The film features both video of the 04 brawl between the Pacers and Pistons, as well as various interviews from the parties involved. Artest was, of course, suspended for the remainder of the season. It was between Artest and Ben Wallace, and then fans, and then cups of beer. I'm pretty interested in going to see this or finding a way to see it. And I think most of it is because how Ron Artest has kind of lived his life and how he's become something
fascinating guy.
After his NBA career.
Fascinating guy. I remember hosting an evening show pining for the Bulls to draft him. I was doing the draft coverage, and they got to that pick, and I was saying, take Ron Artest, take Ron Artest.
What
and they
pick
did.
Would that have been?
It was like 19th or 16th, something like
okay.
that. Okay. And it was, I had just covered him. He was a freshman at St. John's, and I was doing play-by-play for DePaul and got to watch him up close and just see this massive horse of a human being. He's just incredibly skilled. And
big
then,
dude.
And then to have the whole Bulls experience and how weird it was, and I don't know if he was ever diagnosed with any specific issues.
No clue.
But he was entertaining.
16th overall in the 1999 draft. Good memory there. Yeah, I would be interested in seeing their accounts of it. I don't know that I expect to go into the documentary learning anything new about the fight itself.
No.
But I would be interested in their perspective on it.
Many years ago, in whatever iteration of this particular segment it was called at the time.
Oh, no, we've never done anything like this before.
I mentioned news of a controversy in Maryland, and the controversy stemmed over the ingredients in crab cakes and what was being used in Maryland crab boils and crab preparations.
All right.
Because the blue crab for a while was not as plentiful. And many restaurants were replacing the Maryland Chesapeake blue crab with a Thai or Vietnamese blue swimming crab, which is a close cousin, equally as sweet and delicious, much less expensive and plentiful. So the legislature in Maryland changed the rules and made it a law that if you said these are Maryland crab cakes, they had to be officially Maryland crab and not the Thai, the Southeast Asian blue swimming crab.
Did like a champagne thing. Then,
it,
huh?
Yeah. Like a
provincial sort of rule.
Correct. Like an AOC, not that AOC, but yeah, the guarantee, the AVAs, as they call them in California.
Sure.
And now, check this out. In a matter of about 7 years, the Chesapeake native blue crab has invaded and swiftly taken over the ecosystem of the Ebro Delta on Spain's Mediterranean coast.
Not the Ebro Delta.
Yes.
Abe.
That's
Ro Delta.
No, yeah, E-B-R-O, a big crossword puzzle word, Ebro. So this is the actual Chesapeake crab that's an invasive in Spain. No natural predators of the adopted ecosystem, capable of interrupting the food chain by eating the native species that call the region home. So they're not happy about it. Apparently, as cargo ships travel across the globe, they take in and expel water. That's how gobies got into the Great Lakes.
Okay.
They came in from Eastern Europe, and there are all sorts of invasives in Lake Michigan because of just this. And it comes in ballast, but people are unhappy that this delicious invasive is there in Spain. So look, if you know Marylanders, if you know them,
drink Strohs,
you know that they
natty bows,
that just sick them, just get Scott Van Pelt and
that's right, Scott
Chad
Van
Feldman,
right, I forgot,
and get them, and you'll send them to Spain. They will eat all the blue crab, and I will be more than happy to help. Because I will tell you,
I'll do that work.
I've been in a couple restaurants. There's one, I want to say it's in Fort Lauderdale, called the Rustic Inn. Ever been? Where you literally, it's picnic tables covered in newspaper.
Oh, yeah. I've been to a spot like that.
Oh, the Rustic Inn?
And you order, you either order crab or garlic crab. That's it. And they bring you a giant bowl of whole crabs, either regular or covered in garlic butter.
Oh, yeah.
And they give you a wooden mallet.
That's what's up.
And you get a wooden mallet and you get your big bowl of crabs and all hell breaks
loose.
It's
like the scene from A Few Good Men.
And there's beer and there's, at some point randomly, like at a wedding when people clink glasses, randomly someone will start pounding the mallet on the table, and then everybody in the restaurant's pounding their mallets on the table just because somebody else did it.
Well, you have a mallet. That's what you do.
Right. And you burn more calories over the course of the evening. By the time you've gotten through every last bit of crab and you peel up the carapace and you get all the chunks of meat, but it's a workout because you're hammering things and you're just not eating as much as you had. You leave and it's like, oh my God, that was awesome, but I'm hungry.
I hope people are able to make GIFs off of the video stream.
It's been a lot of movements. This just came out about an hour ago, and I find it a fantastic troll. Wizards fans everywhere are rejoicing at the news of longtime president and general manager Ernie Grunfeld being fired on Tuesday. For nearly 16 seasons, he was at the helm, and if you ask the folks of Washington, D.C., he didn't do the greatest job running the basketball team. In fact, his performance made some fans decide to give up on their season tickets. Not because the team itself wasn't playing up to the standard they wanted, but because Grunfeld was still there. And the secret contract extension Grunfeld got last season certainly didn't help ease the tension between the fans and the general manager. Wizard ticket representatives heard all about fans' displeasure with the executive, and they were ready to let people know seats are still available if they wanted to recommit to the team now that Grunfeld is gone. Check this out. A number of former season ticket holders of the Washington Wizards had emailed or had, you know, the robocalls where you go, hey, are you interested in re-upping your season tickets? And they go, no, as long as Grunfeld's around, I'm not bringing my business back to the Wizards. Thanks so much. Click goodbye. Wow. I'm going to eat dinner. Ticket reps, though, logged which fans told them that. And within 24 hours of the news coming out that Grunfeld had been fired, they're starting to call and email and even tweet and get into the DMs of fans that they'd reached that had told them, I'm not coming back until Grunfeld is gone. And these ticket reps are, I don't know, you categorize them. Heartless, just trying to sell,
brilliant,
always be closing, all of those. They're calling back these ticket holders, former ticket holders who wanted Grunfeld gone and going, hey, we fired him. Please give us your money.
They kept the Glengarry leads.
That is, it's amazing. It's just coming out over the last hour because Twitter users are posting about it. It's terrific stuff. I love it.
Bottom of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Four remaining home games. The Wolves' magic number to capture their third straight division title is at 6. Be there Saturday and Sunday as they look to clinch. Tickets start at only $12. Visit ChicagoWolves.com for information. This is Rogers, Arkansas. Why don't you get a good look at these two men right here? Okay.
They look like they're from Rogers, Arkansas.
Two Arkansas men are accused of taking turns in a bulletproof vest and shooting each other.
What?
Eugene.
Yeah, they are clapping on the ones and threes.
Charles Eugene Ferris, 50, was on his back deck drinking with his neighbor, Christopher Hicks, 36, and his hot licks on Sunday when the incident happened, according to the police report. Ferris was wearing a bulletproof vest and told Hicks to shoot him. I demand that you shoot me now. Shoot him now. Shoot him now. So Hicks shot Ferris in the chest one time with a .22 caliber semi-automatic rifle.
I can't imagine this game lasted long.
Just wait. The bullet hit Ferris in the top left corner of his chest, and the vest stopped the bullet. The shot still hurt Ferris and left him with a red mark his chest. Ferris then took the vest off, and Hicks put it on. Ferris was angry about getting shot and how much it hurt. So he, quote, unloaded the clip into Christopher's back.
Oh, cool.
According to the report.
What?
None of the rounds penetrated the vest, but Hicks suffered bruises.
You think?
Ferris went to a local hospital, and staff members there notified law enforcement. Ferris initially told deputies a story about being paid $200 to protect an asset, and that's why he was shot. He was guarding the asset from a man wearing a white suit near Charlie Chan's coming after him, or Mr. Rourke, by a man wearing a white suit near a bicycle and walking trail. Ferris later told deputies he was drinking with Hicks, and they shot each other with bulletproof vests after deputies spoke with Ferris's wife. So both Ferris and Hicks were arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault.
Morons. I've got morons on my team. That is just colossally stupid. The latest trailer and teaser is out for Avengers Endgame. And I have seen, we got our tickets. We're all set. I know a lot of people were frustrated. We're fine. Thanks so much. But I hope you all get your tickets if you want to go see it. There is a theater chain that in select cities is running a marathon of each and every MCU film from Iron Man all the way to Captain Marvel, all back to back. that if you attend and make it through the 60 hours of film in that theater, you will then be rewarded by seeing Avengers Endgame approximately 1 hour before the rest of the country is able to get
into
the movie.
Wow.
I ask you, how? Who is so dedicated to seeing Avengers Endgame 1 hour before? And that's the other thing, too. If you go and see it, it's a 3-hour, 2-minute movie. So if you're seeing it an hour before everybody else does, that means that you will get out of the movie an hour before everybody else. You will tweet about it, and anyone who cares will be in the midnight showing of the movie, still watching it and unable to have anything spoiled for them.
Oh, that's cool.
So could you make it through a 60-hour movie marathon?
No, I could not.
No, I would never, ever be able to make it through there. And you imagine, you think the smells? Those theaters are going to have to be fumigated.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Lastly, Komodo Island is closing. Komodo Island is closing to tourists because, imagine, people are stealing dragons.
Okay.
People are stealing Komodo dragons from the Isle of Komodo.
Now, check me if I'm wrong here, Dan. They are poisonous.
Their saliva is poisonous.
And they can kill you?
They can grow up to 10 feet long and weigh up to 200 pounds. I was lucky enough to be at the San Diego Zoo on the day that the Komodo dragon not only walked out of its enclosure, but walked right up and started flexing and doing a series of seductive poses like Fred Garvin, male prostitute.
Male prostitute.
It was amazing. But apparently there is a ring of lizard smugglers that has been busted. They don't know exactly the reach of the ring. So for now, they are closing Komodo Island to examine the lizard's food supply, work on preserving endemic plant species, survey the natural environment. They're trying to grow the population. But this has been quite the heist when someone has decided they're going to go to the island and steal the dragons. Don't do that. It's bad.
That is the Midday Midway. We'll get over to the NBA with Mark Schanowski. He's the Bulls pre- and post-game host for NBC Chicago. That's up next on Bernstein and McKnight. 670 The Score.
Hey, Schanowski, I heard what you said.
Mark Schanowski.
I've seen a handful of different times where there was video of him lighting up Jamokes in pickup games.
NBC Sports Chicago Bulls pre- and post-game host.
Mr. Carter to you.
The most interesting man in the world.
I'm coming for you, man. You heard it here first.
Mark Schanowski with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
This segment's brought to you by ABC Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electric. Mark Schanowski is on Twitter at Mark Schanowski. You watch him analyzing the Bulls games. He is your amiable host for Bulls basketball at NBC Sports Chicago. And he joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. It is winding down, Mark. Whatever is left in this season, I saw that starting lineup the other day when I was having some TV issues, and here I am watching the Bulls game. And I looked at the lineup, and I asked myself this question, and I will ask it to you. And I don't mean this glibly. How along the very margins of the margins right now can the Bulls be getting closer to winning a championship?
Well, I don't really know what you can do when you've got a roster composed of mostly G League players right now, or at least active players. It's very difficult. You know, Jim Boylan will say they're working hard in practice and the guys are giving their all, and that's a good thing. But in terms of getting anything accomplished towards the ultimate goal, you're really kind of spinning your wheels right now because all the players that are going to be a big part of your future are watching in street clothes on the sideline or sitting at home. And it's just very difficult to say that you're making any great progress other than trying to, build a culture of hard work that Boylan is advocating.
You just, it's the hard work that's continued to be a theme, a teaching point for Jim Boylan over his entire tenure here. Do you get the sense that that is gaining traction, that the hard work has been something, or that preaching has been something that's caught on with everybody?
I don't know about everybody. I'll tell you the one thing that's been a real positive, though, is I think he's won over Zach LaVine, and that was something that was a big source of concern early on, that Zach LaVine had so much freedom under Fred Hoiberg that he was kind of chafing at some of the restrictions that were put on him by Jim Boylan. And, you know, just going back to that whole incident in Los Angeles where Boylan was ejected and got fined, and LaVine offered to pay his fine, and you know, that was legitimate. That wasn't just something that was done as a joke or meant to, you know, to try to just put some light on the whole situation. I think Zach has kind of bought into what Boylan is teaching, and that I think that's a big development in Boylan's future as the Bulls head coach. When you have one of your two or three best players who finally say that, you know, I believe in what the coach is saying, and I think that we can win with this guy. I think that was a big step for Jim, and I think that's going to help them as they head into the offseason and trying to get this going for next year.
Any tryouts going on here among the bottom of the roster guys? Are there spots up for grabs?
No, I don't really think that anything is going on right now that is going to be important in terms of next season's roster. You know, people got excited about Walter Lemon Jr. It was a nice story. You know, he comes home, it's a big game at the United Center. But it's not like he's going to be competing for the starting point guard job next year, or Jakarr Sampson is going to turn out to be the next Bobby Portis or anything like that. They're just trying to fill the roster as best they can and get through these final games and get on with the business of trying to improve the roster for next season. You know, you looked at, got a long look at guys like Wayne Selden and Ryan Arcidiacono, Zach Harrison. Some of these guys could be back, but certainly they'll be in deep supporting roles. They're hoping to hit it big in the lottery, as all 14 teams that are in the lottery are thinking the same thing. You know, hopefully getting either Zion Williamson or John Morant, and which would be a big jumping point for their whole offseason. But the point guard position is going to be addressed with players that aren't currently on the roster right now. And, you know, they've got four starters in their minds that are currently in place, and they're going to fill in with some free agent veterans around the edges. So most of the guys that are playing right now, their best hope for making the roster are spots 10 through 15.
So, Mark, I'm looking around Twitter this morning. I'm reminded that we are in the final, likely the final five games of Dirk Nowitzki's career in the NBA. It's been a remarkable one. I was I had a beer with John Sabine, a Bulls Outsiders, Dallas guy. He swears up and down that Dirk is the best player to ever play because
no,
he's crazy. Well, how will you remember Dirk Nowitzki, and how much potential, how much of a comp should we really draw between his game and Lauri Markkanen's?
I just want to get back to the fact you had a beer with John Sabine.
Well, it was a scotch, but I figured I'd fudge the story a little.
I mean, this guy's manic. He keeps going the whole time. He's you know, a Second City veteran. He's been in commercials and all the rest of the stuff and different TV series and cameo appearances. He's an interesting character. But
he's hilarious.
But yeah, he is. Back to your original point about Dirk, though, I think clearly he's the best international player ever. He brought the big shooting big man to the floor, made it acceptable for a big guy to shoot threes and have a different game from back to the basket. You know, it goes back to the idea that he's one of the guys that didn't want to admit he was 7 feet because he didn't want to get thrown in the post with his back to the basket. And, you know, he's had a unique training system with his personal coach who's put him through some very novel concepts that I think other big men are starting to employ. And he did revolutionize the game. I think he'll be remembered as I said, the best international player ever and one of the top 25 players the league's ever seen.
What was your first thought when you saw not only that Fred Hoiberg had taken the Nebraska job, but my goodness, that contract that he got?
Yeah, the contract is pretty incredible. It's amazing what some universities are willing to offer. Obviously, football is going to be king in Nebraska. That's never going to change. I was kind of surprised because in conversations I've had with him and statements he's made to other people, he really wanted to get back in the NBA in some capacity, whether it was as a head coach or as a front office executive. He told people that he didn't really like recruiting. It was tough business. It was hard on him personally. He didn't really enjoy it at all. So now he's jumping back in it in one of the toughest conferences in basketball. You know, when you think about the ceiling at Nebraska, you know, he talked about the great facilities and everything else down there, but the Big Ten is murderer's row. I would think that, you know, the ceiling for Nebraska is trying to finish fifth or sixth in the conference. It's not like they're going to be competing for conference championships. So I'm surprised that he made that move. But he talked about how important university has been to his family, the family history that they have there. And, you know, hopefully it'll work out for him. It's, you know, very similar to Iowa State, where that was the middle of the pack Big 12 program, and he was able to win a couple of conference tournaments. He's going to try to bring in some transfers and start out that way, but he's got a lot of work to do. The Big Ten is about as tough as it gets in college basketball.
So, Mark, it's Bulls and Wizards tonight. We were just doing a story about Ernie Grunfeld getting axed out in Washington. They've got a complicated roster situation. The Bulls kind of have a complicated one, too, but if you had to put money down on which team is closer to winning their next playoff series, which one would you take?
I would take the Bulls. The Washington Wizards are a dumpster fire now with that John Wall contract hanging over everything they do. You know, he's going to make an average of something like $42 million over the next four seasons. They traded Otto Porter Jr. Bradley Beal is hinting that he wants out, and even if he stays, he's going to want a supermax deal that's going to basically, you know, give those two players 60% of their payroll. I don't know how anybody fixes that in the short term. They don't really have any young players that you're all that excited about. Beal is still young, but he's going to command a huge salary as a multiple-time All-Star. It's a mess. You know, whereas the Bulls have, as we mentioned, have identified four young starters, 25 and under. They've got hopefully a top five pick coming up, and they've got some money to spend in free agency. So I would definitely take the Bulls situation right now.
Mark, thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, guys. I'll talk to you next week.
That is Mark Schanowski of NBC Sports Chicago. We are going to stay basketball-y. After the top of the hour, the Athletic, over the last month at conference tournaments and at all NCAA tournament sites, have been using open locker room access to do something I don't think I've ever seen at the college level.
No, I haven't.
This is an anonymous survey of 110 men's college basketball players. And there are actual quotes here, obviously not attributed.
Anonymous.
But they answered nine different questions, and I think you'll be very interested in how this turned out.
We got a good one coming up. It's Bernstein McKnight, 670 The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.